Today is Monday, April the 30th, 2018, and we are at Raven Landing Senior Community in the Community Center in the Founders Room. I am Nona Howard, and I'm here today with Ann Shinklin. And we want to thank you so much for coming today and for being a part of the Raven Landing Resident Stories Project.
I'm glad to do it.
Good. And first, we're going to start off by asking you a little biographical information about. Tell us where and when you were born.
I was born April 28, 1939. I just had a birthday in Washington, D.C., and I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area.
Oh, you did? Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about your childhood there.
Well, let me see. We lived in Washington, and then after a bit, we moved into Arlington, Virginia, just across the river. And so my elementary school was a parish school in Arlington, Virginia. But then when I went to high school, I went to a Catholic high school in Washington, D.C. And so a lot of the Catholic kids went to these single-sex schools, and mine was all girls. And then there were a number that were all boys, and we all wore uniforms, and we all knew who we were because of our uniforms. And I had to take a bus and two streetcars to get to school because it was so far from where I lived. But all the kids went to and a major hub place to take the streetcars to their school. So, of course, all the teenagers, we were all together and got to know each other, and it was a lot of fun. And sometimes we would cheat and go into the hot shop and have a hot chocolate. And then by the time we got to school, the nuns had not been anywhere probably for a long time. And they thought, oh, you girls, they put blankets on us. And you poor girls, it took you so long to get here. And we'd be like, I know, but we're glad that we're here now, sister. You know, we didn't do that a lot, but we did do it several times. But that was a deal. I mean, it took a long time, a bus and two streetcars.
Yeah.
And we always had so much homework, and I'd have to carry so many books. It was an excellent school run by nuns. And then when I graduated, I went first to Mary Washington, which is a women's section of the University of Virginia. And it was in Fredericksburg, Virginia. And it was just absolutely beautiful campus, unbelievable, like colonial style. I shared a suite with three other girls. We had two bedrooms and a bath. It was just fabulous. And then we had tables, and we would be served family style, you know. And it was a lot of fun, and I really liked it. But then I thought, and I had good education there, and I thought, well, I should go somewhere where there's boys. So, So I decided to go to Connecticut because my dad was from Massachusetts, and, you know, we went up there in the summer, and he would say, look how beautiful it is up here. Isn't this wonderful? And I believed everything he said when I was a kid, you know. Yes, it is the most beautiful place, Dad. So I applied to University of Connecticut and got in, and then that's where I went for the last 2 years of college. And I love the country up there. The country was great. And I majored in political science, and then I graduated, and I went home and stayed with my parents, which I didn't really like. And they
did you have any siblings?
I have one sister.
Is she older or younger?
She was 4 years younger.
4 years younger. So did you have a lot of fun with her growing up, or was she always a little child?
No, we didn't have a lot of fun. My parents didn't get along very well, and my father was an Irish tyrant, and, you know, it was an Irish Catholic family, and I didn't take well to that. You know, so we had a lot of arguments. My mother said we would argue if it was raining or not raining. You know, we would be arguing about it. So anyway, but then I got to know him really well when I was in college, and I began to appreciate the kind of person that he was. And he was very handsome and very achieved and very bright. And I was so...
What did you study in college?
Well, my major was political science. My father wanted me to major in Spanish, and I started with it, but then I didn't want to do it anymore. He thought I could be a translator, go to the UN and be a translator. I didn't want to do that. Growing up in Washington, D.C. is interesting, you know, because it's so cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
And I had no I never heard about states' rights until I went to college, because Washington, D.C. isn't a state, and people don't talk like that. I mean, most of the a lot of the people there have come from overseas or from Asia, from Europe. It's a very diverse, which really is great, a very diverse population with lots of stuff going on, you know. So after I graduated and had my bachelor's, I met some girls I knew, and so we rented a house in Foggy Bottom, downtown Washington, and that was great. We got to go to lectures. We went to go to band, the military bands would, you know, play music, and we could go to all of that. And I thought it was really terrific. And so I started graduate school when I was there, and I went to George Washington University, majoring in anthropology. And I had never taken an anthro course, ever. And this friend of mine, who had been a roommate of mine in college, was at George Washington, and she said, I know this professor that's looking for somebody to hire, because he just wrote a book and he needs someone to do the index. Would you like to do that? I said, sure, I'd love to make some money. So I went to meet this guy, and then he said, well, you have to take one of my courses. He was an anthropologist, had worked in Anaktuwik Pass. And I said, sure. Well, I just was raptured. I was taking education classes at the same time, because my high school had called me and said one of the teachers was sick, would I come in and substitute? So I did, and I loved it, and I never thought I wanted to teach, but I really loved it. So then I thought, well, I'll take the education classes, get certified, but I took the anthropology class at the same time. And I hated the ed classes so much that I just fell totally in love with anthro, and then found out I could get a master's in 2 years, you know. So I decided to do that, and my parents were like, what are you doing? I said, it's okay, it's fascinating. So while I was in graduate school, this professor from Madison, Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin, came to see my professor, and he introduced him to me and some of the other graduate students, and they were recruiting for a graduate program focusing on the North, on Alaska, Canada, you know, all northern studies, northern places, and they wanted people who were interested. So I said, sure. So I got in there, and I was another grad student. We drove up there, and I knew this lady from George Washington, and she had a house. No, first I stayed, but the first year by myself in an apartment, and I really didn't like that. It was kind of scary. But I loved the studies. I just loved it. I mean, I was going to be an anthropologist. And so, of course, I had gotten my master's from George Washington. So while I was in Madison, I was working on my PhD in northern anthropology. So let's see. So when I was in grad school, a couple of years, and I had this teacher I just adored, and there weren't many women professors, of course, at that time. This was 1964, hardly any women. And I just fell in love with this woman. I thought she was such a wonderful teacher. And she had worked in Yukon Territory for a long time. And so she came and asked me if I wanted to go with her in the summer to Yukon Territory. And she'd gotten a grant from National Museums of Canada, Ottawa. And they didn't like to fund women. I mean, I was very lucky that I had a woman teacher and was willing to take me in the field, because they just didn't think it was safe for little girls to go in the field, which was ridiculous, you know. And so if you were on the tundra,
we're tough stuff.
Yeah, if you were on the tundra, they would say, where are you going to go to the bathroom if you're on the tundra? You know, there's no trees. You know, I think people could figure it out. So I went with her and two other guys from the grad program. We flew up to Whitehorse.
What year was this you first came?
Okay, wait a minute. I think it was 66. And so we worked in Whitehorse, Champagne, and Kluane Lake. And I was there like a week, and I was just like, this is the most beautiful place I have ever been. You know, I just fell in love with the country. And of course, I'd been studying the history and the government and the culture of the natives and all that stuff. I mean, I was totally into northern studies. And so they had found a site at Healy Lake in Alaska, And so the two boys who were friends of mine were archaeology students. And so they said, do you want to come with us? Because the professor was going back to Madison. We're going to go over, drive over to Alaska, and we're going to test this site. And I said, I'd love to come. So we drove over, and that was very exciting. We were almost killed by a helicopter that had had stopped for fires, and just came right down the road at us. It was all very exciting. And I grew up in a city, Washington, D.C., and my family was not outdoor people. You know, I didn't know anything about stuff like this. So I was completely in love with the country. So we drove to go to Healy Lake, and we stopped in, must have been Delta, and we stayed here on campus in the dorms. Uh-huh. And I was just, you know, College Road was a dirt road then.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought it was all quite fabulous. You know, and they had scantily clad ladies downtown dancing in the bars, and I just thought, this is cool. This is really nice. And so we drove down the road, and all of a sudden we went off the road into the woods, and there was an Indian in a boat waiting for us on the river to go to Healy Lake. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, we're going somewhere, you can't get there unless you go in a boat or a plane, you know? Now this was new. So we got in the boat and we went, and there was an Indian family that lived there. I've forgotten her name, she was well known. And she had a bunch of kids. And one of the girls was like a teenager. And when we got there, she said, come with me, she said. I'm going to take you for a boat ride. I said, sure. So I went with her, and we're out there, and we start dumping over beaver dams in this boat. Going like this, and then all in the air and over the beaver dams. Well, I thought, this is fabulous. I'm so lucky. You know, I was lucky. And so we set up camp where the site was, and for, I don't know, about a week or 10 days, we tested and we found artifacts, and, you know, it was really cool. And then this well-known northern anthropologist who was at Dartmouth came and joined us, and he was an older guy, a New England guy, and he was like, well, I've never been in the field with a woman. This is very strange. You know, he really didn't know what to do with me. And I was like, it's okay. Don't worry about it. It's fine. Everything is fine. He'd say that almost every day. I can't believe there's a woman in this camp. You know, that they were so backward then. I mean, really backward. So after Healy Lake, then we came out and I flew home, had, you know, millions of slides, and told my family all about it. And they were just like, oh, you're not going back, are you? I said, well, I would like to go back. And so then I went back to graduate school, and then I got married, which was kind of stupid, but I got married. And
where did you meet him at school?
In grad school, yeah. And he was studying Siberian prehistory, and he was studying Russian and reading all this stuff. Anyway, so let me see. We had a little girl, and I was a teaching assistant working to make money, and I actually drove up to Sheboygan once a week to teach at the extension up there to make money to help support us. And of course, my husband didn't do anything. He just went to school, and it was not good. And so what happened? Okay, so he got a grant to go to Siberia to look at archaeological collections and see how they compared with the Alaska collections. Well, I had a major professor who was very wealthy, and he was my husband's advisor. And he came and he said, Ann, I want you to go with him, and I'm going to pay for it. I said, you're going to pay for it? He said, yes, I'm going to arrange everything. And you will go with him, and you will fly to Japan, and I'm arranging a tour for you in Japan. I couldn't believe this. Like, what? A tour in Japan, and then you'll take the boat, you know, to Siberia, blah, blah. So my parents came from D.C. to take care of the kids. And
so how many did you have then?
I had two, and my baby was only like 2 months old. A boy, I just adored him, and I didn't want to leave him. I did not want to go. but I thought I could not pass it up, you know. So we went, and of course my parents came, and we went. It was a very interesting trip, and we decided that we were going to keep our mind open to the Russians, you know, and not get this whole communist thing crazy. And we went on the boat, and I forget where we went. Well, we were near Vladivostok. Oh, it was a horrible Soviet ship. And they had a radio on in each room. They could hear us. They taped everything we said. I mean, that's the way they were then. Maybe they still are. And so we got to Siberia. We got on the train, and we went to Irkutsk. And I tell you, I don't think they'd seen very many Americans at that point. And we stayed in this rundown hotel, and I went to have my hair done. And they were like, I was an alien from outer space. They were like, look at her hair, you know, and all this weird stuff. The women and I just sat, just smiled and sat there, you know, and they fixed my hair. It was a very interesting experience. And then we met with the archaeologist, and you know, everything, and maybe it's still the same. Everything broke. You know, if they would get in the elevator, they'd say, well, we hope we're going to make it, but, you know, it's Soviet technology. You know, and all the doors were hanging off the hotels. I mean, unbelievable. And the pens would break, pop out. I mean, it was really terrible. And so I thought, these poor people. Well, the archaeologist was just wonderful. We loved him, and we had a great time. And then we went to Novosibirsk, which is Science City in Siberia. And so all the best academics go there and live there. And we went there and stayed in the hotel. And we met with three or four of these hilarious archaeologists. And we looked at their collections and visited and blah, blah, blah. And when we left, they took us to lunch, and they drank brandy like it was water, you know, so we'd have all these toasts at lunch. Well, I could hardly walk after lunch. And so we had to get in the car to go to the airport, and they were talking about World War II and how they had gotten to know Alaska pilots when they were flying, because they were bringing supplies to them and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, do not mention Stalin. We don't talk about that anymore. And they would just like be shaking, you know, it was so horrible. So we go to the airport, and one of the guys carries my pocketbook. It was so funny. I was just laughing my head off. It was hilarious. And so they walked us to this car, and we went to the airport, and we flew to Moscow, and it was terrifying. They always put us in seats where the window was covered so that you couldn't see out. It was just for foreigners. Regular Russians had regular seats and regular windows. And all the planes had been military planes, and so they were fitted up for guns. I mean, it was weird. So when we flew to Moscow, I swear to God, there was air blowing on me. And I said, I am terrified. Air blowing inside the plane. I didn't know if there was a hole or what was going on. It was so primitive. I mean, it was really primitive in 66. So, no, that was in 70. It was 70, 19. My son was born in 1970. That's the year we went. So we get to Moscow, and we only stay there a few days because we were supposed to go to Leningrad. So we go to Leningrad, and we meet these archaeologists. And, of course, Leningrad is very beautiful. And we had a dreadful time. We couldn't get any food. They didn't want to serve us in the hotel. And we had coupons for food, you know, Air Tourist or whatever they're called over there. It was awful. And so the Americans in the hotel sort of came together as a group to figure out how we could get fed, because we'd go into the dining room and nobody would wait on us and they wouldn't bring us any food, you know? I mean, it was a problem. And so, yeah, it was funny. I mean, we laughed because we were with other Americans who were saying, can you believe this? And no, we say, no, we don't believe it. And in the morning, people would come down in the lobby and drink liquor with their breakfast. It's unbelievable. So, but the people were really good to us, very nice. But that time in Leningrad was really tough. And so then we took the train back to Moscow. And we were going to be in Moscow for a week or so. But then I got a telegram from my parents saying, we think you should come home. The kids are getting really difficult. I had a daughter who was kind of difficult. And she really missed us, you know, and my heart was broken when I had to leave them. So who are those people? What is that airline that they use there? They run your life. And so we had coupons to do this and that and eat in certain places. And we said we wanted to go to the ballet. Did we go to the ballet? Yes. And while I'm in there talking to these people, it's a big room like this, there's all these other people wandering around having arguments with these people who worked for the airline, you know. And there was this couple in there just having a fit. And they said, we went to the ballet last night. It was supposed to be, what's the famous ballet? It was supposed to be blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't. She said, it was. And they said, we were there. It was not. She said, what they said to you all the time was, it's impossible. That's what they would say. It's impossible. So, yeah, it was just, you know, a different culture. And these women were impossible. And so I listened to this fight, and I thought, oh, dear God. So we had to change our travel. Well, let me tell you, you just don't change your travel in the Soviet Union. And I said, we need to go home because my parents have sent us a telegram, and they say we need to go home. They said, impossible. I said, it is possible. And I said, that's before we went to Leningrad. I said, we're going to go to Leningrad, we're going to come back, and we want to fly home. She said, well, you can't change your travel until you go to Leningrad. I was like, I'm going to lose my mind, you know? And so I said, well, okay, so we have to go to Leningrad before we can change our trip to go home. And she said, yes. So we went to Leningrad, and as soon as we got there, I was with the travel people saying, we need to leave as soon as possible because we need to go home. Well, we didn't get out of Leningrad, and we went back to Moscow, and I started all over again, and my husband never got it. He would not confront anyone. And so I'm down there fighting with these people. You know, when is the next plane that's going? Well, we'll see if you can get us on it. Well, they're going where, blah, blah. And then she said, well, there is a plane going to Stockholm. We had no intention of going to Stockholm. I said, we'll take that plane. In fact, I'll get on any plane that's leaving now or tomorrow. Any plane, just get us on it. So they did. They got us on the plane, and we went out to the airport. And, of course, that was all. Oh, and we were followed everywhere we went. I mean, when we walked out of the hotel, these people in raincoats followed us. It was just, it was a real eye-opener.
Yeah.
And, of course, everything was very bland. You know, it was store number one, store number 35, it was horrible, and I felt really sorry. And you know what? There were no phone books. No phone books. Because when we got there, we wanted to look up the archaeologist's phone number to call them. There were no phone books. It was like a secret what your phone number was. It was.
So you came back.
Yes, so we came back. Oh, but what happened, and that's why I started talking about this, we flew to Anchorage from Madison to get the plane to go over to Japan. Well, when we had friends who were anthropologists who were in Anchorage, who were teaching there, we were going to stay with them one or two nights. Well, when we landed in Anchorage and I looked around and I said, we're moving, you know, I want to live in Alaska because all this country, you know, I was just... So we called, we knew the people in Fairbanks. The two of the people who had been graduate, one was Father Loyens, and the other was John Cook, who'd been in grad school with us, and they were teaching at UAF. And I said, call John Cook and tell him we want jobs. So he called him, and he said, we want jobs in Fairbanks, and we were just finishing. And so he said, well, let me see what I can do. So my husband got a full-time job, and I got a half-time job to start first year. Second year, I had a full-time job. And so we moved to Fairbanks, and I was in heaven. I mean, I was so happy because I love the country. You know, I just love the trees. I love everything about it and the people, everything. And so man, I worked hard. I had two little kids and a husband that didn't do anything. And I was teaching the same load he was, and he was full-time. And I was half-time, because that's the way they treated women. And so I think the second year I was there, I became full-time. And when I went to the dean for my evaluation, he said, "Ann, do you know you're the best teacher in the college?" I said, "No, but I'm really happy to hear that. Thank you for telling me." Well, the same year, the government came in because they said there was discrimination against women at UAF, and I got a big raise. It wasn't that much. It still wasn't as much as my husband was making, but at least I was making more money. And so my husband went back to Madison and defended his dissertation. We worked on it here, and he went back, and by that time, I was really finished with him. And this very good friend in Anchorage, who was just a wonderful scholar, we visited them on the way back from Madison. And he said, "Ann, I have a site for you. I found a site that would be perfect for your dissertation." And I said, "Oh, Bill, that would be wonderful." And so he told me it was out of Copper Center and all about it. And then my husband is talking about, well, he's going to go do a site. And we're looking at him, "No, it's my turn to get my degree." So that made me really mad. And so then I said, "You know, we're getting a divorce. This is ridiculous, so I'm not going to go through that." But we did get a divorce. And then I took the kids and
went to college.
Graduate students with kids who'd never been in the field because they were women. And I took some of my male students. It was all UAF students with me to be my crew. And we had a tent city we set up outside of, along the Copper River, close to O'Brien Creek. And we had, there was a cabin there, so we used the cabin for our meals and stuff. And we had to haul water. I mean, it was something else. And it was...
Now, what year was this?
That was probably like, let's see, I came and...
When you were divorced.
70, probably 75, 74, 75. Yeah.
And you had two kids.
I had, yeah, two little kids. And this other graduate student, she had two little kids. And so we hired a babysitter to come with us. And it's a miracle it worked out. I mean, we were up on a cliff overlooking the Copper River because that's where the site was.
Yeah.
And it had been a chief's village is what we got from the oral history from the Indians. And so this babysitter took care of these four kids. And we all lived in tents and, you know, cooked our food and hauled water. I mean, it was something else. See, and some fishermen would come and give us fresh fish, salmon, you know, that they'd gotten at O'Brien Creek. And then I worked with the Indians, and they would come all the time to the site. They wanted to see what was going on and what we were digging up and, you know, all of this stuff. And so by that time, I was a confirmed Alaskan. You know,
I'm never leaving.
No, like when I came here, I said, "I'm going to live here. I'm going to die here. This is my place," you know, and I still feel that way.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then I taught for a long time, and then I became the dean of the College of Liberal Arts. And that was a very hard job. And then I met my husband and fell in love with him, and I was about 50. And I was divorced, and he was divorced, and we had this very romantic, he was very old-fashioned, and he courted me, and I mean, it was fabulous. And so I fell madly in love and married him. And we stayed married until he died about 10 years ago. He had cancer. He had a heart attack, and we hadn't been together very long. I woke up and he was walking around the room and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I have a pain in my chest." I said, "Get in the car now. Get in the car." You know? And I rushed him to the hospital and I won't go through that. But he had a transfusion in Anchorage and he got hepatitis C. And that's what killed him because it turned into liver cancer. It was just bad luck and he never said, "Why me?" He never complained. He just, you know, okay.
So you had a wonderful ending life with
him.
Yeah,
we did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we went to Europe a number of times. We did a lot of things.
Good. What's your fondest memory, do you think?
You know, I saw that question, and I was thinking about that, and I thought, oh, my God, I don't know. I think, well, one of my fondest memories is of my husband courting me because he was a gentleman and, you know, just was wonderful to me. But I was thinking now, what things have happened in my life that I'm really fond of? Well, I was very fond when I became the dean.
Like, yeah, I guess so. That was
pretty exciting, you know. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. And the only reason I applied, because there was a guy on the faculty that was a finalist, and I hated him. And I thought, if he becomes the dean, I'll have to go to another university. So I better sign up for it. So I did. And then I got it.
Good. Okay, what brought you to Raven Landing?
Well, I never thought I'd live with a bunch of old people. I'll tell you that. I mean, I never did. And when we were outside for a while, because my husband wanted to take a job in Idaho for a while, and I was furious the whole time. I wanted to come home. And so, and he was 12 years older than me. And so finally I said to him, we were in Arizona, and I said, I'm going home and I'm going to build a house. I'm not going to stay here, you know, and you're going to get sick and die and I'm going to be alone. And I hardly know anybody in this town. Well, he was furious. He didn't want to do that. He didn't want to do that. He didn't want to go back. I said, well, I'm going back. And so, oh, it was right at 9/11. Oh. That's when it was, because none of the planes were flying. And then I flew, it was one of the few flights after 9/11, and he wouldn't come with me. And so I flew up here. And I stayed with Mike and Jane Krause, and they had a party and invited all the liberal arts people that I knew, and it was wonderful. And Judy Kleinfeld said to me, listen, I know this guy that's doing these houses now, and he's one of the best builders in the state, and he's coming to my class to talk, so why don't you come and I'll introduce you to him. Well, it was Jack Hebert. So I went and I met him and I just loved him and he loved me and he took me and Jane Krause came with me, and there were two plots left in this place that he was building these beautiful houses up over Farmer's Loop. And so I said, well, I want one of these two lots. And so he said he thought I should take this lot because if I was alone, people would be able to see me and, you know, I wouldn't be isolated. So I went home and I told my husband, I said, we're buying a piece of, he almost had a heart failure. And I said, I'm buying it, Bill, and I'm building a house. Oh, he was furious. He didn't speak to me for about a month. And I just said, this is the right thing to do, and this is what we're going to do. And so I was a little scared, but, you know, my friends were all behind me. And so we came up, I got the money. Thank God my mother had left me enough money so I could pay the whole thing off. And so we made the plans, and Jack sent the plans to us, and we went over them and argued about it and carried on about it, and then signed up, and he built us the most beautiful house. And I said, I want to see the woods everywhere because I have missed them so much. I said, build this house in the woods, and I can see the woods everywhere. There were big windows. So I could look out and see the forest everywhere. And I was so happy. Oh, my God. I was so happy. Well, by this time, the kids were grown up. I mean, my daughter had gone to Maryland and finished a journal after she came to UAF, and then she went to Maryland, finished a journalism degree. She worked for Clinton on the campaign, his campaign. She called me up and said, I think I should work for Clinton. I said, sounds okay to me. So, you know, she worked for him. And then she got on the, I was worried. I wanted her to get a job. I mean, she was finished with school, but my mother lived in D.C., so she stayed with my mother. And she called me and said, you know, Mom, I think I'm going to work for Clinton. I said, sounds good to me. So she got a job. Then he won. She was on the transition force. And the next thing I know, she's in the trade office working with the press, you know. So I'm like, well, good for you, you know.
So you don't have that worry anymore.
No. Well, now she's on TV.
Oh.
Yeah, she's on CNN all the time with Anderson Cooper. You know, and she's like, I never want to be on TV. How did this happen? I said, I don't know, but it's okay. And then my son went to Albuquerque, And I kept telling him, you should be a teacher because you love children. They had gone to this hippie daycare center here where men worked. And so Matthew learned that it was okay for men to take care of babies and little kids, you know? And I wanted him to learn that because there wasn't a man in the house. So he came back and he decided he did want to teach. So we had to do 2 more years of school here at UAF, which was fine. And then he got his teacher degree. And it was about a year before he got a job. He got a job at Eielson, which we were all hysterical about because he had to drive in the winter down there, you know, but he didn't care. He got an apartment. He was going to do that. And then thank God he met this wonderful woman and he had millions. He's a very handsome guy, millions of girlfriends. I didn't think he would ever get married. And then finally he met this woman and he told me, I don't know why I didn't meet her before. I know every woman in Fairbanks, you know, because lots of women, you know, dating. Anyway, one day, I was so glad I was here for this. I think Bill was gone by then. And he called me one night, it was the middle of the week, and he said, well, we're going to go out to dinner tonight. I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, we're going to go down to Alex's. And he said, I'll meet you there. Well, it was snowing, and it was the middle of the week. And I thought, what are you doing going out the middle of the week? You have to go to school early tomorrow. So I went down there, and we're sitting there, you know, ordering our food, ordering a glass of wine. And this young woman walks through the door in these high heels, this beautiful blonde, high heels like this. And she comes right over to the table. Hi, Matthew. I said, oh, now I know why we're out for dinner. And he said, Mom, this is Kelly. I just met her, and she's a good friend of Alex's and blah, blah, blah. And so we visited, and I'm like, holy cow, you know. And so he drove me home, and then I said, well, are you going to be going out with this woman? Oh, yeah, he said, I really like her. And her stepmom told me that the next day Kelly at breakfast had said, I met this man and I really like him. I mean, they were like in love immediately.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and I was so happy. And so they started dating, and then her father owned the Switzerland, and so they lived in the apartment. There's an apartment upstairs in the Switzerland, and he was my baby, this guy. You know, we have a mutual admiration society, my son and I. And so so then one night he called me up and he said, well, he said, I think I'm going to get married. And I said, well, Matthew, you have to ask her. Oh, yeah. I said, okay, I will. I said, you ask her. And I hung up and I thought, oh, God, he's going to get married finally. And so then the next day he called me and he said, well, we're engaged. I said, well, that's wonderful. And he said, and we're coming up to your neighborhood to look at a house. And I thought, I can't believe this, you know. So, and he said, we'd like you to look at it with us. It was a block from my house. So, oh, Bill was still alive because he couldn't believe it either. And so they came and I went, and she told me when she came home from work that he asked her to marry him, and he said, hurry, we have to go. The jeweler's staying open so we can pick out your ring. And I was thinking, and I had called my daughter and said, do we need to give him money so he can buy her a ring? I mean, I didn't think he had any money at all. Well, he had it all picked out. They went down, they got the ring. They pick out this house. The next day she calls me and says, we're going to buy that house. She's a realtor, so she knew how to handle things. We've made an offer, and they've accepted it. And I was like, oh, thank you, God. And I knew I was going to be a widow because Bill was already sick, you know. So they moved in the house. Well, even before that happened, the next day he called me and said, we think we might have a baby. I was like, are you trying to kill me? I said, I'm going to have a heart attack. And so she was like 2 or 3 months when they got married. She had the most beautiful wedding gown. She starved herself, and she was just gorgeous, and it was a gorgeous wedding. And they've been my best friends ever since.
So, okay, now how did you decide to come to Raven Landing?
Well, okay, so I'm living in this house that I had built in a neighborhood where everybody's wonderful, and we all know each other, a lot of people from the university. And so then Bill died, and I'm by myself. Even though my son is down the road, you know, and I know I can get help, and the little girls just come and knock on the door and say, hi, Grandma, can I come in? I mean, it was wonderful. But my knee started to bother me, and I had a two stories, main floor, and then down to a guest room and bathroom and the garage. And the freezer was there, so I had to go up and down the stairs. Well, my knee started to kill me, and I thought, I have to get in a single-story place. And so I told my daughter-in-law, I said, we have to sell the house. I can't stay here. I've got to find somewhere else to live. And then I had heard about Raven Landing. And I knew Ann Tremorella was here and some other people I knew. So I came down. I had a meeting with Susan. And she took me around, showed me the apartments. I thought the apartments were fabulous, you know? And I was used to having to drive so far to go anywhere, you know, from being way over Farmer's Loop, way back in the woods. I thought, this is good. And so I thought, this is what I'm going to do. And so I got on the list, and I went down to Arizona. I think I had just bought the house in Arizona. An Alaskan had invited me to come and stay with her for a month and bring the dog. And it's like we've got four or five households from Fairbanks in this little neighborhood, and we all know the same people. It's wonderful. It was a community waiting for me.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And so then while we'd gone out to lunch, a bunch of us, and I get a call that they have an apartment. Well, I almost had a heart failure. I was so excited, you know? And so I told Kelly, sell the house. I'm moving into Raven Landing. Well, she sold the house in 2 days, you know, because it was a great house.
Yeah.
And we put a decent price on it, and I moved in.
And so what's your experience here been?
Well, I really like it. I mean, it took me a while to get used to it. But, you know, I moved into building 3 when I first came here because I wanted a 2-bedroom because of the grandchildren. And so the grandchildren came one night, and I said, well, let's fix up your bedroom. And they said, oh, no, Grandma, we're sleeping with you. And I'm like, what? So they want to sleep with me. They're not sleeping in another bedroom. And so I had a couch that opens into a queen bed in the living room. So I put them in the living room, and I slept in my bedroom. And I'm thinking, why am I paying $500 a month to have a bedroom that I don't use? So then I decided I had to move into one bed. I had a fabulous apartment. Looked out on birch trees. I mean, it was fabulous. But I just thought, this is crazy. So then I went on the list for 1-bedroom. And, of course, now I have a wonderful apartment, and we have a yard, you know, because I told Susan I have to put up a fence. I didn't want that fence. And she never talked to me about it. She just had it put up and then sent me a bill. You know, I was not happy, but we now have a yard, which I'm trying to take care of, and it's very hard, but I've made good friends here. And 2 of them are the women from Building 3, who are my close neighbors, Louise Grish and Carol Stevenson. They're still 2 of my best friends.
Good.
Yeah, and of course, I know a lot of other people here who've moved in, and I love a lot of the people in Building 3. And I love to cook, so it was not my deal that I needed to have food. You know, and if I like the look of the menu, I eat it. Otherwise, I cook. And I invite my friends. We have dinners all the time. We're all cooks, and we all love to cook and drink wine. And so I have people come to my house, and I go to their houses. And it's perfect, and I love the location.
Yeah.
You know, we're close to the doctor. We're close to the hospital. We're close to the movies.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you coming and giving your story today. And it was just absolutely wonderful.
It's a good story.
It is a good story. And we appreciate you contributing.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Oh, sure. And you're doing a great job.
Oh, thank you.
You are great.